From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Jackie Leiden. This episode, the sweeping reach of phone and internet surveillance by the NSA took many Americans by surprise.
All that stuff can be analyzed in such a way that it really tells a lot about who I am and what I think.
We take a look at the history of privacy in America. How much are we entitled to? And what are our rights? And later in the podcast, what are our legal rights to water? We take it for granted, but in parts of the U.S., there's not enough for everybody, and it's beginning to cause problems. Then we hear from Dr. T. Barry Brazelton about his very long career as a pediatrician and go-to guru for parenting advice.
Every time I see a new baby, every time I talk to a new parent, I learn from them.
And Matthew Morrison, also known as Mr. Schuster on the musical TV show Glee, has a new album out, putting his twist on old American classics.
I'm singing in the rain.
That's all on this week's podcast, so listen up and enjoy.
Glorious feeling, I'm happy again. I'm laughing at clouds so dark up above. The sun's in my heart, and I am ready for love. Let the stormy clouds chase everyone from the place.
On Friday, the sun was shining here in Washington, D.C., as tourists strolled the gravel paths of the National Mall. And up in Franklin Square by the White House, locals on lunch break filled the benches and ledges. We went out and asked people a simple question. What personal information would you be willing to give up in the name of national security?
Assuming it's going to be used by agencies and it won't get out, it'll be protected. Not a lot. I like my privacy. I don't want people knowing where I'm going, what I'm doing, and who I'm talking to.
It's getting a little bit scary, actually, that more people than should know what I'm doing.
Once you start giving certain information in the name of national security, when does it stop?
I don't do anything to protect because I feel like it's worthless because I'm only one man and this is against the United States government.
The voices of Arvis Layton, Fred Metzger, Amanda Munsell, and Gerald Perriman all sharing their thoughts on today's cover story, the present, the past, and the future of privacy in America. Americans have worried about being watched since the colonials lit a candle and put quill to paper. Even in the wake of the massive new revelations from the National Security Agency, polls show we've got mixed feelings. Fox News, CBS News, and Gallup all find that more than half of all Americans don't approve of the NSA's collecting our phone and internet records. Young Americans profess to value their privacy even more, and yet feel just as ambivalent as older generations when asked about the NSA activity. Which brings us back to Franklin Square. Michael Lissman says that in this era of internet sharing, he just assumes people are watching and collecting his information.
So yes, there's certainly things I don't necessarily want the NSA to find out about me, but I don't know how to stop them, so I just try not to do those things.
When we asked if he did anything to actively protect his information, he just laughed and shook his head.
I think once I tried to find the privacy button on Facebook, that's about it.
And not everyone opposes the NSA surveillance anyway. According to those same three polls, about 40% of Americans are comfortable with the agency's tactics. That includes Dakota Beach and Tony Robertson, who outright approve of them.
I think that you have an obligation to all the citizens in this country, as a citizen of America, to share any information that's going to be able to help the government keep our country safe.
You know, in order for us to be protected, they have to take whatever measures are necessary.
I want security, yeah. And I want it at any cost. Oh,
well, that's Otis Redding's opinion. On the other hand, there's this guy.
I'm not sure that much of my information is needed for security. And if there is a need for mine, I'd like to know why.
That's Dr. Larry Hunter. Now, today, Larry Hunter is a professor at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. But back in 1984, most of us were blissfully unaware of anything like email, and Google hadn't even been invented. One man looked into the future, though, and didn't like what he was seeing. Larry Hunter, then a grad student studying computer science.
I was doing daily life online then. I had friends that I emailed back and forth with. In 1984, that was pretty rare.
And that's when Hunter, a child of the Nixonian 70s, made a realization. It wasn't the Orwellian camera in the bedroom that Americans needed to worry about.
But instead, all the stuff we do in public, when I go out and I buy something at the store or I make a phone call, all that stuff can be analyzed in such a way that it really tells a lot about who I am and what I think.
So Larry Hunter wrote an essay. He outlined the possibilities of data collection in a paperless society. The ubiquity and power of the computer blur the distinction between public and private information, he wrote. Larry Hunter was, in 1984, talking about what we now call social media, information we willingly share. The next year, his essay was published in the Whole Earth Review, and looking back now, it's impressively prescient.
Well, I got some of the names of things wrong, but it was pretty close.
He'll admit there's something in which he fell really short, and that was how to stop the privacy invasion. He and a friend did have one idea.
We thought that people ought to inherently own the information about them and have some property interest in it so they could control what's done with it. And I think it's too late for that. The Googles and Microsofts of the world would lobby against that so fiercely that it really has no chance.
As for Dr. Hunter and his friends now?
We're a little cautious. Some of us like to use encryption to talk to each other so that it's a little harder to listen in on us. I still believe almost everything that was in that original 1984 piece.
As it turns out, Dr. Hunter's concerns about privacy are not new. Let's go back to that colonist, the sheet of paper, the quill pen, and, of course, a knock at the door.
If you want to talk about privacy, what would be less private than having a platoon of redcoats living in your house, eating your food, listening to your conversations?
That's Neil Richards. He's a law professor at Washington University in St. Louis, and he says that Americans have feared for our privacy for longer than we've called ourselves Americans. And yes, he is from England.
You can even view the Puritans as wanting a kind of privacy, a privacy of conscience from the state. But in the Constitution itself, the quartering of soldiers, the execution of general warrants, all have to do with the privacy of the home and the privacy of papers. And though the Constitution doesn't use the word privacy, the separation of individuals and their information and their homes and their persons from the state is a theme that runs throughout the Bill of Rights.
That was even true at the beginning of, say, the camera age.
That's right. Privacy as a theme in American law and really in American public discussion arose in 1890. Louis Brandeis, the famous Supreme Court justice, when he was a young lawyer, wrote an article in the Harvard Law Review complaining about the intrusions that the new snap cameras were having upon the affairs of the great and the good.
You know, many people would say that the history of the U.S. when it comes to privacy is also about the history of the press itself. But by the 1960s, that had become very sort of embattled relationship. What happened in terms of collecting information along about the 1960s?
Lots of things happened in the 60s. On the one hand, you had the growth of pre-modern computers, what they then called data banks. Today we'd call it a database. There was a great amount of social anxiety, news magazines on hour-long primetime on CBS about the dangers posed by data banks. At the same time, you have the Supreme Court handing down cases on obscenity possession and also on wiretapping, protecting privacy to read and privacy to talk with one's confidants over the phone. And then, of course, President Nixon, the great villain, I suppose, in the story of American privacy, recording conversations in the Oval Office, authorizing break-ins to get papers and records of his political enemies. So right after Nixon's resignation, there was great political push to have privacy law. So we see the Privacy Act, which regulates data held by the government. They were going to extend it to private sector data, but never quite got around to it.
Coming up to the present, did 9/11 change our sense of giving the government permission to snoop?
Immediately, it certainly did. I can remember living in Washington at the time, and even committed civil libertarians were saying, just give the government what we want. We're terrified. People are dying. We're afraid. I think we're ambivalent about the issue that we call privacy. On the one hand, we want to be safe from crime and from terrorism. On the other, we want to be able to share information on Facebook. We want to be able to talk on the phone. We use cloud services. On the other, we actually do feel violated when people are listening to our conversations or reading our emails or getting our reading list from the library. The challenge that we're facing is how to strike the right balance, realizing that information is never or rarely purely private, but at the same time, perfect security is also equally impossible.
Neil Richards of Washington University in St. Louis. As to the future of privacy, well, maybe we'll have to learn to live with NSA surveillance, says Roberto Baldwin, a writer for Wired, but only if we continue to communicate in the loosey-goosey way we have been.
There are ways around being eavesdropped on by the government, but it's also a little bit of a pain.
Well, I'm up for a little pain. You wrote a little article for Wired about this, and, you know, if it means that I can go a little further and keep my privacy, I would like to learn how to avoid the government's unblinking eye, okay? Where do I begin?
Well, the first thing you're going to want to do is your smartphone or your cell phone that you have now, leave it at home, smash it, throw it in the fireplace, do something with it, because your calls, while they may or may not be able to listen to what you're saying, but they are being tracked. So what you can do is you can go down and you can get a burner. If you've ever watched The Wire, you may know about burners, but they're phones you can purchase from an electronics store that you pay with cash. It doesn't have any record of who you are when you're using it.
Now, wait just a minute here. I just bought an iPhone 5. I have to smash it?
Well, you don't have to smash it, but just don't use it. Okay. Don't take it with you either, because
use
they can
the
check you with the GPS. They can use a cell phone towers to triangulate your position. They know where you are at all times.
And how's my mother supposed to reach me?
Well, you give her the number, but you're going to want your mom to get a burner as well.
Ah.
So that's the thing, because they could still track your mom's calls. Your mom is still calling this number, and then maybe they could figure out that, you know, you live in that area, and then it's all for naught. Everyone you know has to buy a burner.
What about, you know, email? Is my email safe?
Well, are you using Gmail?
Who isn't?
Well, okay, stop using Gmail.
Oh, great.
You need to use something like Hushmail. And while you're using your email, you need to use it through a browser that is using something like Tor. Tor, it was actually developed by the U.S. Navy and allows you to send encrypted messages, and people can't find out where those messages are coming from. They won't be able to track your IP address. So you can go to the Tor website and download their special Tor browser. So you have to use a special browser. Don't use Flash. Don't watch videos. Don't do anything, because that will give away your position. And then from there, you can use Hushmail or some other secretive email account that you could find.
I wish you could see the sad face I'm making right now.
And then at the end of the day, the person on the other end, if they just print it out and hand it to the government, it's all for naught.
I was hoping you could tell me that if I just wrap tinfoil around my laptop, I'd be protected.
Well, that's, you're just going to get people to look at you. Who's that lady? We should be tracking her.
Roberto Baldwin. He's a writer for Wired Magazine, and he joined us from member station KQED in Where Else, San Francisco. Thank you, Roberto.
Thank you.
Water. So often, we take water for granted. We turn on the faucet, there it is. We assume it's our right in America to have water. And yet water is a resource. It's not always where we need it or there when we need it. Rivers don't follow political boundaries. Rivers flow through states over international borders. And there are endless demands for water, for agriculture, drinking, plumbing, manufacturing, to name just a few. And then there's the ecosystem that depends on water getting downstream. So what are our legal rights when it comes to water? And who decides? That's our cover story for today. There are two doctrines that govern surface water rights, one for the western United States and one for the east. The riparian doctrine covers the east.
The riparian doctrine, if you live close to the river or to that water body, you know, lake, you have reasonable rights to use that water.
Venki Udumari is a professor and the director of water resources at Texas Tech University.
The western United States uses the prior appropriation doctrine, where as people started exploring the West and started looking for water for agriculture and mining, there was a need to move water away from the rivers.
People wanted a claim to water, but often lived too far away from a river for the riparian doctrine to make any sense. So the prior appropriations doctrine was devised. Udumari explains that.
It allocates rights based on who started using the water first. So if you're first in time, you are first in rights. And historically, it was based on a permitting process where you go and say, like, you know, you asked for the permit first, so you became the first user. But then there's been a shift saying, you know, not first use strictly based on who asked for the permit first, but who was actually there first. Like, you know, so the Indians or the Indian tribes who were there first, you know, may not have asked for a permit, but there's recognition now that they were the first users of water, so they get that first appropriation.
Prior appropriation has sparked controversy in Oregon. This week, water regulators ordered ranchers near the headwaters of the Klamath River in southern Oregon to shut down their irrigation pumps. The state says it was necessary to protect treaty rights of American Indian tribes who live downstream. But the water shutoff jeopardizes a multi-million-dollar cattle ranching industry. Amelia Templeton from Oregon Public Radio went out to the watershed to see what's going on, and she brings us this story.
I'm standing on the banks of the Sycan River. This little tributary is one of dozens that join together and form a massive lake in southern Oregon's Klamath Basin, which in turn feeds the Klamath River. Tributaries like the Sycan provide water for salmon and suckerfish all along this river system. The Sycan is also where rancher Becky Hyde gets her water.
We irrigate out of the Sycan River, and water makes things magical wherever you end up putting it.
Hyde's ranch is a square of bright green that stands out in the dry juniper and sagebrush. She has a water right, or in other words, a permit from the state to take water from the river every summer for her 500-acre ranch. Hyde uses the water to grow grass to feed beef cattle. Up until last week, a giant pivoting sprinkler was irrigating this pasture.
Hey, babies. Come on, you guys.
Where she's raising about 80 one-year-old cows.
Yearlings are my very favorite because you can just sit, and if you're quiet, they will all come circle around you, and pretty soon they'll be licking your foot.
But Hyde is trying to figure out somewhere else to move these young cattle. She's one of many ranchers along the upper tributaries of the Klamath River whom the state ordered to stop irrigating. The move came after the Klamath Indian tribes, just downstream, said they needed more water left in tributaries to protect their fishery. Hyde is upset, but she also respects the tribe's right to the water.
This is a tragedy for this community and for our family personally, but it is also a wake-up call to say people besides agriculture have a water right.
When all of this country was developing, no one was really thinking about fish or wildlife.
That's water rights attorney Bill Ganong. For decades, the government encouraged draining marshland and converting it to farms. As a result, Ganong says, the state of Oregon handed out lots of water rights.
You don't own the water. Your water right is the right to use it. It's a right of use.
In an arid place like the Klamath Basin, there often isn't enough water available for everyone who has a right to use it. And the person with the oldest water right gets all the water that they are entitled to first. For 38 years, groups in the Klamath Basin have contested who holds the senior water right on tributaries, like the Sycan River. The state finally reached a decision this year. The date of the tribe's right, time immemorial. Every spring, the Klamath tribes hold this ceremony to celebrate the return of the suckerfish. The now endangered suckerfish were once the staple food of this tribe. They look a little like miniature sharks with a vacuum cleaner for a mouth. Don Gentry is chairman of the Klamath tribes. He says they've not been able to fish for suckerfish for the last 27 years.
The condition of our fish is so dire. They're on the brink of extinction. And I believe that those fish are an indicator of the health of the watershed.
The tribes are in negotiations with ranchers to come up with a better plan to share water in dry years. Gentry says that even though it's an uncomfortable situation, the Klamath tribes have a responsibility to ensure that suckerfish and the river ecosystem itself survive. For NPR News, I'm Amelia Templeton in Medford, Oregon.
Water management may seem like it would be more of a problem in the arid West, but it's a national issue.
Oil was probably the fluid of last century where there was a lot of turmoil, and I think water is the fluid of this century.
That's Michael J. Walsh, a major general with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
And I'm the deputy commanding general for civil and emergency operations. The Corps of Engineers operates hundreds of reservoirs across the nation, and we impound trillions of gallons of water regulating the flows of multi-state river systems, but all of them have put into effect by congressional mandates. We did a lot of the construction in the 1920s through the 1940s.
Since those dams were constructed, demands on the water stored behind them in reservoirs has changed. That's certainly the case for the Chattahoochee River. It flows from the Georgia Mountains through Metro Atlanta, down Alabama, through Florida, and then into the Gulf of Mexico. And as Metro Atlanta expands, the city sucks more water out of the Lake Lanier Reservoir on the Chattahoochee, which means people living downstream in Alabama and Florida have less. And since the Army Corps of Engineers operates the four federal dams on this river, the Corps is right in the middle of the conflict. Operation orders come from Congress. They decide what the Army Corps should do based on compacts worked out between the three states. But, says General Walsh,
in this case, the Congress did put a compact together, and they did work for, I think, 5 to 8 years to see if they can work through that. The states couldn't and have been bringing lawsuits against the Corps of Engineers and other federal agencies to prevent us from updating the water control plan until they come to some agreement.
This is an issue that's been going on for literally decades.
Gil Rogers is an attorney with the Southern Environmental Law Center. He's been following the Chattahoochee water wars.
It really began when the Corps of Engineers, which operates the dams that control the lakes above Atlanta, started to think about revising how it was going to manage those dams. And, of course, that means there's going to be a difference in how much water goes downstream. And so Georgia's neighboring states, Alabama and Florida, were paying very close attention, and ultimately all of that ended up in court, and the court battle went on for literally over 22 years.
Interstate compacts were created to try and resolve the conflict, and the issue went all the way to the Supreme Court.
These river basins are not following political boundaries, and they flow from one state to another and from one community to another, and there's a lot of tension over how much water is going to be available for everybody to do all the things that we need to do with these rivers.
Where do things stand now in terms of disputes about how to use the river's waters?
Well, the Corps of Engineers has kind of got the next move. They are revising their protocol for operating their dams, and we expect that to take another few years. They're going through an environmental impact review process now that we'll have to see what they come up with in terms of how much water they're going to be releasing from these dams.
So in your judgment, what do you think needs to happen to reach an acceptable resolution?
We've got to continue emphasizing water conservation and water efficiency, particularly in Metro Atlanta, but going all the way down the system. And that's for all water users. The Flint River is a companion river to the Chattahoochee, and it's basically been put in a permanent state of man-made drought because of all of the water withdrawals that happen from that river. It's just not a sustainable pattern.
Are there any lessons for water resource management that the rest of the country can learn from what's been going on with the Chattahoochee, as an example?
We've seen a lot of these conflicts play out in the West. I think we really need to start thinking about how we're growing, where we're growing, and whether there's enough water available to sustain that growth. And that's not something that we have been used to doing in the past. It's been much more opportunistic, and the water supply issue has been more of an afterthought than a forethought. And so I think one lesson is just to put good management policies in place on the front end so that you're not trying to play catch up. Is something that will ultimately guarantee good, sustainable economic growth as well as better environmental health for these river systems.
That's Gil Rogers of the Southern Environmental Law Center. Two rivers on opposite sides of the country, the Chattahoochee and the Klamath, may provide lessons for the inevitable and growing dispute over how we manage our most precious resource, water. We turn now to a man who's helped change the way we think about and care for our children from the time they take their first breaths. For the better part of a century, Dr. T. Barry Brazelton has been studying babies and sharing his knowledge. He hosted the long-running TV show What Every Baby Knows, and he's written more than 30 books on child development. Hospitals worldwide rely on his newborn assessment, known as the Brazelton Scale. And at age 95, the renowned pediatrician is still going strong. His latest book is called Learning to Listen, A Life Caring for Children. It begins with his own boyhood in Waco, Texas, where his grandmother made the prescient observation, Barry's so good with babies.
Well, she'd put me to work every Sunday on the front porch of her house while my parents went in to have cocktails and get drunk. I would sit out there with six younger cousins and have to take care of them for about 3 hours. And so right from the first, I learned that if you watched a baby and listened to them, or a child, they would tell you what they were about to do. And I could stop them before they got in trouble, not afterward.
This seems radical at the time, because really up until World War II, in which you served, people didn't think of babies as separate beings who had personalities, right?
I think because we lay them out on a cold slab, didn't swaddle them, and then confronted them with noises and sights, and these kids wouldn't respond. They'd habituated. So as soon as you wrap them up and cuddle them and bring them up to an alert condition, they'll do anything you want.
I'm going to try that on a few people I know. But you know what? You know, that brings me to something about this book. It's a bit of a travelogue in places, and what's really fascinating is the years that you have spent doing extensive research into the ways that other cultures approach caring for newborns. How would you say that American methods of early parenting compare?
I don't think it compares very well. I wish that parents were like the parents I saw in Kenya or in southern Mexico, where they carry their babies around and learn about them right from the first. Unfortunately, in this country, we tend to put a baby down, tend to talk on our cell phones rather than looking at him and speaking to him.
I was so taken by your description of mothers and babies on Japan's Goto Islands. And these are remote little fishing islands. Tell me about what you learned there. It's quite remarkable.
Well, we spent several years there studying babies. And we realized that these mothers never moved fast. They never got excited. They spent most of their days knitting nets for their husbands fishing. And so when the babies were born, they were already very quiet, gentle. And when you picked up a baby in the Gotos and got him alert, he would follow you back and forth for 24 minutes without a break. And then I did the same study on babies in Tokyo with the same genotypes. Mm-hmm. And their mothers rush around. So this 24 minutes was already down to 18. And then when I went to Los Angeles, it was down to 8. So it taught me that intrauterine experience is very important.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that I've learned over there was how wonderfully these mothers were treated right after a baby came.
This is amazing.
They were treated like newborns. They were wrapped up with the baby, and they were put on a futon with nothing to do but nurse the baby. They also were picked up and taken to the John and fed like a baby. There was absolutely no postpartum depression.
Oh, my goodness. Is there anything that a modern, typical American mother, what can we take from the Goto Island mothers?
I think we've got to fight like I have for longer parental leave, so we can keep mothers at home and have a chance to learn about their babies, learn about themselves as parents. I would like to hope for 6 months, but we're down to 3 months in this country, and that's really not enough.
When you were starting out, Dr. Brazelton, right after World War II, could you have envisioned yourself still plugging away many years later at age 95?
No, I certainly couldn't.
Does it feel like you've seen it all, or do you continue to learn from babies and young children?
Oh, golly, I don't want to give up. I learn every time I see a new baby. Every time I talk to a new parent, I learn from them.
Renowned pediatrician Dr. T. Barry Brazelton, his new book is called Learning to Listen, A Life Caring for Children. Dr. Brazelton, it was such an honor. Thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Well, thank you, Jackie. This was wonderful.
Last February, a murder at a remote Texas gun range captured the headlines.
An ex-Navy SEAL and one of America's best-known snipers murdered at a gun range in Texas, allegedly by a troubled former Marine. This comes.
Chris Kyle was a sniper in Iraq and the author of a best-selling memoir about his experience. The man who confessed to killing Chris Kyle was a young, mentally ill veteran, just one of many mentally or physically injured vets Kyle took shooting in an effort to help them heal and readjust to civilian life. At the time of his death, Chris Kyle was writing a book about the history of firearms in America. That book, called American Gun, has just been published posthumously. His widow, Taya Kyle, spoke to us from the family home south of Dallas. She says that her late husband loved history and wanted to place his own experience with guns in a historical context.
He always saw himself as just an everyday guy in different situations, and he had a tool. There are always everyday people in extraordinary situations throughout our history who use the tools available to them to change history. And it was just a perfect fit for what he'd been reflecting on.
Taya Kyle, you've taken up your late husband's mantle in more ways than one. You've written the foreword and the afterword to this book. You've spoken out for vets' benefits. You've also spoken out for the gun rights, spoken to the NRA at their annual convention this year. Your husband has a very large profile. What do you want and hope that his legacy is going to be, and how do you think firearms are going to be part of that legacy?
Well, I certainly don't pretend to take a political stance. I feel that we should have the right to bear arms, but I don't mean it so much as a political statement. And certainly, American Gun was never intended to be a political statement in any way, shape, or form. As far as speaking at the NRA, I just wanted to represent that there is so much good being done every day with guns, and I don't want that to be forgotten.
William Doyle was the co-author of the book American Gun, and he completed it after Kyle's death. He says that Chris Kyle saw guns as an inescapable part of the American story.
Not really for better or worse, just because of the nature of our country. All Americans are connected, one or two steps removed from firearms.
The narrative of guns in America begins at the Battle of Saratoga, and it wasn't going well for the colonists on the ground. Then one soldier climbed into a tree with an American long rifle and fired the shot that took down a British general. It would change everything.
That one shot early in the American Revolution helped turn the tide of the Battle of Saratoga, and the Battle of Saratoga, the American victory, is what brought the French in to support the Americans, which arguably was the decisive strategic factor of the American Revolution. So, it shows you how sometimes a single bullet can change history, in our case, for the cause of freedom.
The last gun in the book is the M16 rifle, and this is now the weapon of choice for the U.S. military, has been for a long time. It's the gun that Chris Kyle used when he was a sniper in Iraq. Let's talk about the M16, the birth of the modern assault rifle. Assault weapon is a term we hear a lot today. What is the history of the assault rifle exactly?
The modern assault rifle really traces back to Lincoln's quest to get an edge on the battlefield, and that turned into what's called repeating weapons, which helped win the West, both to slaughter an enormous amount of buffalo and also to win the Indian Wars, very tragic Indian Wars. But the repeating rifle, something that you could crank off several rounds with and get distance and power and accuracy with, was another historical milestone in the evolution of weapons. And I think that they all sort of flowed into the idea of a modern assault rifle.
You wrote this book with Chris Kyle, and he was famously the deadliest sniper in U.S. military history. And earlier this year, as we know, he was killed on a shooting range by a fellow veteran who had PTSD. I'd like to ask you to read a paragraph that sums up the inevitable duality of guns.
Sure. Well, in our book, Chris wrote, "Whether they're used in war or for keeping the peace, guns are just tools. And like any tool, the way they're used reflects the society they're part of. As times change, guns have evolved. If you don't like guns, blame it on the society they're a part of."
You know, he's no longer here, of course, to explain that paragraph. But for you, what is the purpose of this book in the national conversation we're now having about guns? And did he speak to you about that at all?
Chris Kyle made me realize that at the same time we're very aware, and we should be, of the tragedies that can occur when guns are in the wrong hands, Chris reminded me very much that my life depends on guns. My life walking out the street here in New York City depends on a man or a woman with a gun three blocks away and their ability to defend me against evil. My life depends on guns in the sense that there are men and women in the service all around the world right now who are literally, this is not just a slogan, they're literally protecting my freedom and my ability to shoot my mouth off and behave as an American citizen.
A point that Doyle and Kyle make frequently in this book is that guns are only as good or evil as the people who use them, not a point everyone is going to agree with as gun violence escalates. I asked Taya Kyle whether in the wake of her husband's murder, she thinks there's anything that could or should have been done that could have prevented the tragedy.
Anytime someone dies, I think that it's normal to look back and think, could have, would have, should have, and how could we have changed it? But I can say that Chris certainly should have had more information about the person who he was trying to help, and that's troublesome.
In the book, and in your essay, you write that firing weapons like this for veterans, especially veterans who seem to be struggling with PTSD, could be healing. And I have to ask if you haven't revisited that notion.
No, it's a fair question. I think that what we have to remember here is that a lot of veterans are outdoor type people. The place where Chris died is a very beautiful place with wildflowers and buffalo, and it's a very healing type place. Most of Chris is something other than guns and being a sniper and being in the military even. Chris was a big-hearted, loving man who he had a disarming ability to put people at ease.
Hmm. You seem very composed, and I'm sure that that wasn't easy. You have young children and you're young people. You must miss your husband very much.
More than I can say.
Taya Kyle, I so want to thank you for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Taya Kyle is the wife of Chris Kyle, the high-profile sniper who was killed in February by a mentally ill veteran in Texas. The book Chris Kyle was working on when he died is called American Gun. It's just been published posthumously.
My name is Irfan Ali. I am from Kuram Agency, Turi Tribe.
Irfan Ali is one of the 17 photographers, including six women, who came to Washington recently to display their work at the Institute of Peace. Their show is called Pakistan Through Our Eyes. Two of the photographers are Huma and Seema Gul, sisters.
My name is Huma Gul. I'm from Momand Agency. My name is Seema Gul, and I belong to Momand Agency of Pakistan. These are the tribal areas of Pakistan. We call it FATA. They are comparatively backward areas and not developed as much as the other part of the countries.
Huma and Seema Gul, who both attend the University of Peshawar, say the people they photograph in the tribal areas aren't used to cameras and can be suspicious. It can take weeks to gain the trust necessary to make a simple photograph. Huma tells a story of one of the pictures she took. An older woman is sitting on a carpet outdoors holding a large radio.
She was sitting with her grandkids once the men were out for work. And once she was done with cooking and stuff, she had this huge radio and she used to listen to it since there are electricity crises in that area, it's not easy for them to watch TV and have access to internet. It's like they don't even know about that. So the radio and the local channels are the only way of communication, and it's like a link to the world. So she was just relaxing with her grandkids, and they were enjoying this local music on the radio. So that's how I made that photograph.
It's a really happy but engaging picture.
Exactly. Yeah, that's my personal favorite.
And it certainly speaks, I think, to the power of radio. And Seema, you made a picture of a bride.
Yeah, I know her personally. I went there, and like in photography, you have to know your subject. So I spent time with her, and it was her wedding day. So I took a lot of pictures, and one of them was selected.
There are very few female photographers in Pakistan, but these young women are passionate about it. Another member of the group, Saba Rahman, explains that women can take pictures that men cannot.
No man can approach women in that areas. So being lady, we can approach them. So we can highlight their problems. There are so many girls and women who want to say something to the world, but they don't have any approach to the world.
Bringing images of their world to an American audience was only half their mission in Washington. This week, all 17 Pakistani photographers fanned out to document everything from the halls of Congress to, well, Irfan Ali went to a famous D.C. haunt.
I was shooting from the last 4 or 5 days in U Street. So here I found best moments, especially in the Ben's Chili Bowl.
Ben's Chili Bowl.
Ben's Chili Bowl.
President Obama has visited Ben's Chili Bowl.
Yes. When we are going to Ben's Chili Bowl, the National Geographic photographer tell us that this is the famous place because Barack Obama eat burger over here.
I just have to ask, you're wearing a gorgeous white shalwar kameez today in the studio. Is that how you photographed on U Street?
No, in Ben's Chili Bowl, I wear jeans over there.
Seema Gul photographed a more serious venue, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial.
That was a quite emotional place, and I really had to work hard there because there were people who were a part of the war and they didn't like to be photographed. But again, it was just blending in. I just wanted to be, you know, to just look like them, so just they don't hesitate in telling me the stories. And since it's important for photography to know your subject, so in this short time, I tried my level best. I went there at sunrise, at sunset, to capture the emotions, and I did that. I'm happy that I captured those moments, and I can show it back in Pakistan as well.
You can see these photographs on our website at npr.org. In one of them, a horse charges along a stream. It's the holy day, Friday. So the horse, a beast of burden, is being given the day off, its legs painted gold with henna, flying along in the sun. And it's time now for music.
When you're a jet, all the way from your first cigarette to your last dying day.
That's actor Matthew Morrison singing West Side Story medley. Now, you may know him as Mr. Schuster on the TV show Glee. His new album, Where It All Began, is a tribute to the classic Broadway standards that he grew up listening to and eventually performing. Morrison fell in love with the theater at the age of 10 after his aunt and uncle encouraged him to try acting.
They kind of threw me and my cousin into this children's theater kind of thing in a production I'm sure you've heard of called The Herdmans Go to Camp. I don't know. It was that moment. The lights hit me, and I felt so comfortable standing in front of a room full of strangers. And ever since then, that feeling has never gone away, and I never want to let go of that.
Well, you know, you kind of made your bones, I suppose you could say, with Glee, but you attended New York University's famous Tisch School of the Arts for a couple of years before you joined the Broadway adaptation of Footloose.
Yeah, I went to NYU for 2 years before getting Footloose on Broadway when I was 19, and I inevitably ended up dropping out of school.
Was that a hard decision?
Not at all. They had a very strict no audition policy, but I kind of went against that and just said, you know, I'm just going to go for it. And sure enough, my third audition, I got the job.
Wow. And Where It All Began, an homage to your own love of Broadway and Where It All Begins for you. So this is your second album and so many great covers on it, from Younger Than Springtime for the musical South Pacific,
which you starred in on Broadway, Singing in the Rain. Let's listen to your version of Singing in the Rain.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain. What a glorious feeling, I'm happy again. I'm laughing at clouds so dark up above. The sun's in my heart and I am ready for love.
It's a big number to tackle, Matthew, and you did perform it on Glee, and you did this mashup with Rihanna, version of Umbrella.
Umbrella, yeah.
So what made you want to record it again for your album?
This is the song for me that is a big tribute to my idol, Gene Kelly. He's the guy that kind of made dance cool for me. You know, I love Fred Astaire, too. I love watching him dance, but he is the aristocrat.
An aristocrat, exactly.
Yes, and Gene Kelly is the proletarian. He's the very average blue-collar worker. And I guess he reimagined dance for me. He made it a guy's sport, and that really, you know, kind of set me off.
Let the stormy clouds chase everyone from the place. Come on with the rain, I have a smile on my face. I'll stroll down the lane with the happy refrain. I'm dancing and singing in the rain.
How did you decide what to include in this album? There's one here that I really love, and that is On the Street Where You Live from My Fair Lady. The way you sing that song is just so beautiful.
Thank you. You know, that's one of my favorite songs of the album. I love singing that song. It is actually the song I sang for every single audition I've ever had in my life, including Glee. That is like my go-to audition song.
On a lilac tree in the heart of town. Can you hear a lark in any other part of town? Does enchantment pour out of every door? No, it's just on the street where you live.
You know, it's got a great story. It's about a guy who is in love with a girl, but that girl doesn't know or care that he's alive. But, you know, this guy is suffering, but he suffers so beautifully that you almost don't want it to end. I mean, he might, but, but you know, it's just good storytelling. You don't find that in music so much these days. I feel like I can act these songs. And that's a great power to have on stage, to have such a great story that you're not just standing up there and just singing a song. You can act these songs, which I love to do.
People stop and stare, they don't bother me. For there's nowhere else on earth that I would rather be. Let the time go by, I won't care if I can't be here on the street where you live.
I'm speaking with actor and singer Matthew Morrison. He's got a new album out. It's called Where It All Began. Can we just talk about another one that I really love, and that's from Oliver, As Long As She Needs Me. And I just love the yearning in that song.
Yeah.
She doesn't act as though she cares.
That song, it's typically sung by a woman, but who says men can't feel the same passion and despair that women can? Women say it, that's who. No, I'm just kidding.
Took the words out of my mouth.
No, but I mean, you know, some men are willing to give up everything for the woman they love, and I just love singing this song. It's so beautiful. One of the most beautiful songs I feel like I've ever had the opportunity to sing.
As long as she needs me, I know where I must be. I'll cling on steadfastly as long as she needs me. As long as life is long, I'll love her. Somehow I'll be strong as long as she
Matthew Morrison, although you've starred on Broadway in many successful shows, you were nominated for a Tony for your performance in The Light in the Piazza. And I think it's safe to say that probably a lot of people know you from Fox TV's Glee, where you play Will Schuster, the high school Spanish teacher and the Glee Club leader. Let's take a look at this scene from the show where you're singing Vanilla Ice's Ice, Ice, Baby.
Really? All right.
All right, stop. Collaborate and listen. Ice is back with a brand new invention. Something grabs a hold of me tightly. Flow like a harpoon daily and nightly. Will it ever stop? Yo, I don't know. Turn off the lights, huh? And I'll glow to the extreme. I rock a mic like a vandal. Light up a stage and wax a chump like a candle.
What made you cringe just now when I said, let's go to Ice Ice Baby?
You know, I said that there's great storytellers and rappers like Eminem and stuff. Vanilla Ice, probably not included in that category. It's just silly. It's silly.
So you've got this new album, and I would imagine it's got you thinking. Any plans to return to Broadway?
Absolutely. I mean, that's been in my plans the whole time. Especially now, having done Broadway, having done recording, having done television, having done film, I feel so lucky to have kind of gotten to experience all of them. But it's made me definitely realize that my heart is on the stage. And I love live theater. I love the interaction with the audience. And it's something that I'm thirsting to get back to.
Yeah. Well, Matthew Morrison, it's been a great pleasure to talk to you.
Likewise. I had a great time. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Actor and singer Matthew Morrison, his new album is called Where It All Began, and it's out now.
I guess when you met me, it was just one of those things. But don't ever bet me, 'cause I'm gonna be true if you let me.
And for the week ending June 16th, 2013, that's the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Becky Sullivan, Liz Baker, Amy Held, and Lily Percy, with help this week from Erica Morrison, Elizabeth Wynn Johnson, and Shula Newman. Our interns are Rachel Rood and Jan Stewart. The technical director is Daniel Shukin. Bethoni Maturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Jackie Leiden. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.
Won't you come along with me to the Mississippi? We'll take the boat to the land of dreams, steaming down the river down to New Orleans. The band's there to meet us, friends to greet us, where all the light and the dark folk meet. Heaven on earth, they call it Basin Street. Basin Street is the street where the elite always meet down in New Orleans, land of dreams. You'll never know how nice it seems, or just how much it really means. Glad to be, yes sirree, welcome's free, dear to me, where I can lose my Basin Street blues. Oh, you're gonna love me like nobody's loved me. Come rain or come shine, happy together, unhappy together, and won't it be fine? Oh, sunny, we're
But